Today's show is brought to you by Hearst Ranch Grass-Fed Beef, available on the internet at HearstRanch.com.
Broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Welcome to the Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here today with the Ulterior Epicure. But people actually know your name now, Bonjwing Lee.
Right, yeah. Bonjwing Lee.
You had this alternative life or this pseudonym for such a long time. Does it feel nice to have shed that?
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah. It's strange because actually last night I was talking to Marco Canora, who was at a dinner that I was at, and he said, you know, you were anonymous for so many years, and then all of a sudden last year you decided to come out, and, you know, how was that? And I thought, well, it really wasn't a secret towards the end of my my period of anonymity, yeah. So I just decided to come out on my own terms instead of letting someone else do it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's no different, I mean, I suppose, but you know, I'm just kind of a private person, so
yeah,
don't really...
So, we'll get to what the Ulterior Epicure is in a second, but you grew up in Kansas City.
That's right.
There probably weren't many Bonjwings.
No.
around.
No.
What is your background? How did your family end up there?
Sure. My parents are both from China. Well, my father was born in Shanghai, but my mother was born in Taiwan, although her parents are from China. And they immigrated to the United States in the late 60s, early 70s. And my dad went to law school in Ohio. My mom went to graduate school at Kansas State University in Manhattan, Kansas. And my dad's first job out of law school was in Kansas City. So they kind of met in the middle, got married, and settled down there. And that's where I was born.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you, you know, lived there, went to school there.
All through high school. And then college was in Chicago, went to Northwestern. Then to Hollywood for a couple years. Then to D.C. for a couple years. I worked for a senator on Capitol Hill. And then to law school in Ann Arbor. And then interviewed with some law firms around the country and then decided to go back home.
Yeah.
My family's still there. So
yeah.
Yeah.
Kansas City, known for barbecue.
That's right.
Are there any other signifying foods of KC?
Barbecue, meat, corn, bread. We're the bread basket of the country, you know, and we produce a lot of meat.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess barbecue is really what we're known for, called one of the capitals of barbecue.
Yeah.
It's not the capital of
barbecue. So, I mean,
steak.
Did that help your fascination with food, being in the breadbasket, being around barbecue, or did you grow up eating Taiwanese, Shanghai style?
Well, my parents did cook Chinese food at home, more than my parents, actually. It was my mother's parents, who lived also in Kansas City, who really cooked very traditional food. My grandfather was Fujian and he loved to cook. My grandmother also was a very good cook. So I grew up, yes, with that sort of immigrant kitchen at home. You know, it's been told many times by many other children of immigrants where their parents pack them the most god-awful things to go to school, and you open it in your lunch bag and everyone else's bologna sandwiches and you've got like a tea egg with like a drumstick and chopsticks. No, I did have that upbringing.
Yeah.
But also, I think what really caught my imagination with food growing up was that my mother worked for TWA, Trans World Airlines,
yeah,
which was based and headquartered in Kansas City at the time. And she was in management. She had pretty good seniority, and so we flew for free. Our whole family did. And my mother was very adventurous, and both my parents were, and they took us everywhere.
Awesome.
I mean, as a child, I grew up, and I was very privileged because we would fly everywhere, and we'd fly first class, because it was standby.
Yeah.
You know, we were non-revenues, and we would standby, and it was sort of like choose your own adventure. Domestically, my brother and I would take turns choosing places to go. My parents would just say, you know, where do you guys want to go this time? And so we would take turns choosing. But internationally, because the flights were sometimes often tight,
mm-hmm,
we would go whichever flight was open. So
awesome.
We would fly to St. Louis, which was the hub, and we'd look at the monitors, and my mother would check the computers to see what flights had the most availability, and we might have ended up in Rome or Paris or the Bahamas or Frankfurt or Egypt, or Greece. I mean, we didn't know where we were going, and it was always an adventure, and it was great.
Yeah.
So, and when we went places, my parents really wanted to show us that the rest of the world didn't live and eat like we did in America, that we were very privileged in the United States to have so much food and so much everything. So when we went places, we always did what the locals did. We sort of stayed with the locals stayed. We went to, you know, we ate where the locals ate. We ate local food. So I grew up eating around the world.
Yeah.
And I tell my mom to this day that, you know, the best gift she ever gave me was she gave me the world as my classroom. Really, it was the best learning experience ever growing up. And I was very, very curious as a child. So yeah. Very adventurous, and I loved it.
So where do you return to? Because now, as the Alter Epicure, or as Bonjwing,
yeah.
You do make destinations, food destinations, and travel literally just to eat.
I do.
Yeah.
And I've been doing that for a lot of my life, actually. You know, I started the blog in 2004, I think. It was in law school. But even before then, I loved to travel and eat, even in college and before that. But of course, now I've sort of... yes, I do. I travel all around the world, and I make that my point.
Yeah.
I mean, I love going to museums. I love art, too. So I try to roll that in, or, you know, music. But primarily, I go where the food is.
Yeah. What's the furthest you've ever traveled for food?
The furthest I've ever traveled for food?
The most obscure. What are these destinations? Because, you know, Paris, Rome, many sure. people, you know, are attracted to those cities for their food, for their culture. But what are some of the more eccentric, esoteric places?
In 2006, I took for the first time, I went to mainland China and sort of had a two-week trip there and just ate all around. And that was... that we went to some parts of China that, you know, most people wouldn't go. And we have family members.
Yeah, such there. As where?
So in Suzhou, which is, they call it a suburb of Shanghai, but really it's like 2 hours outside the city, and it's still considered, and Suzhou itself is like 3 million people or something ridiculous like that. But we you know, we traveled a little bit around. Hong Kong is pretty far. I don't know if that's obscure.
Yeah.
But Hong Kong. And in Mexico, I've gone to a couple of places with my friend Adam, who has a blog, A Life Worth Eating, and he goes there a lot. So, you know, I've been there with him. I wouldn't say anywhere obscure, you know, Oaxaca.
But just recently
Puebla.
You were in
sure,
Mexico.
Just last month, I think, even. Yeah.
Yeah,
last month I was up in Monterrey.
Yeah.
And then down to San Pedro Cholula, which is where he usually stays, near Puebla. And then we went down to Oaxaca together for
awesome.
A couple days.
What restaurants did you go to in Mexico?
In Monterrey, there was a restaurant that's called Pangea. Or Pangea, but they pronounce it Pangea. And it's a part of a restaurant group there. And the chef there does sort of this modern revisionist cooking of Monterrey. In Oaxaca, we went to this amazing place called Unanisa. And the woman who cooks there, her name is Doña Ofelia. And she's got like three last names. Pineda, Baca, Toledo, or something like that.
That's
Toledo,
a huge
Baca,
business
Pineda.
Card.
Yeah, seriously. But she's a what they call a culinary anthropologist. In fact, I think Rick Bayless has invited her to Chicago a couple times to sort of talk to his staff about, you know, traditional food. But she is encyclopedic in her knowledge of the food of the Istmo region, which is the narrowest strip of Mexico down in the south of Oaxaca. And she's from there. And she makes the most amazing mole. I mean, she really does. And I actually brought some back to the United States, and I've been eating it since. But she does amazing food. There's another woman down in Oaxaca as well who runs a sort of, it's a restaurant, I guess they call it, but it's more like a supper club because it's in her home. And you kind of have to know about it and ask, you know, call ahead to make a reservation. She'll cook out of her kitchen, and you sit in her dining room and she feeds you. And her food and her restaurant's called La Teca. And she also is also from the Istmo region where Doña Ophelia is from. So those were the two of the most amazing places I ate, I think.
Yeah.
Just really good food.
Yeah. Obviously, listening to you talk about these places, it's not just, oh, that was the best burger I ever had. You care as much as that other person being an anthropologist of food. You wrote a book with Megan and Colby Garrelitz.
Yeah, of Blue Stem in Kansas City.
You like that. I mean, you like photographing. You like documenting. What was that book experience like, and how much more do you want to do with photography and writing and food?
The book, working with Colby and Megan, was great because they had been friends of mine for years, and I had been actually nagging Colby to do a cookbook. I was like, you know, Kansas City really needs a chef who does a cookbook. And I didn't actually intend for, you know, him to think that I wanted to write it. I just thought that he should do it. And after about 3 years of nagging, I decided to just, you know, stop because he was too busy. I figured, you know, he's just too busy. And 6 months later, out of the blue, he calls me up, and a publisher, a local publisher, Andrews McMeel in Kansas City, had approached him about doing a book. And so he asked me if I would do the writing, and I said, sure. And then later on, I became the photographer of the book as well. But it was a great collaborative experience, and it was great, especially because we were just friends.
Yeah.
And working with friends, I know sometimes can be dangerous, but we're so laid back.
Yeah.
And we just had fun with it. And just to tell the story of Blue Stem, I do like documenting things.
Yeah.
And I like storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
In college, I was a film major, but really I was a screenwriting major. I was focusing on screenwriting. And I love telling stories. And I love the story of food, and I love the history of food. And that's really what fascinates me most about food.
Yeah, I mean, even just reading your website, Ulterior Epicure, I've always been fascinated, obviously, with the photos, being a visual person, but there was so much more behind the dish that you actually deconstructed, not just the technique, but, you know, the influences, the ideas, and having that knowledge of worldly food, you had some kind of comparative dialogue that I think a lot of food bloggers didn't.
Well, thank you. That's very nice to hear, because I know that probably most people know of my blog because of food photos. And I mean, sure, it's quick, yeah. It's accessible. People can get in and out, and they can look at the food photos and move on. I know that's what most people are really interested in. But I spend more time writing than I do editing photos or anything else.
Yeah.
The photos, really, when I started the blog, was just sort of like a visual aid to help me remember what I ate.
Yeah.
And I'd never intended that to be focused, but, you know, as time went on, of course, I understand people want to see what the food looks like. That's really, the visual part is really what attracts people first. But yeah, thank you very much, because I do spend a lot of time writing,
and I wonder
if anyone ever actually reads what's between the photos.
And it shows, too, from your lawyerly background, how you write and how you plot things out. It's not just, you know, these tangential. It's really well thought out and really well scripted, also from your screenwriting background.
Thank you.
But going down to Mexico, is there the intention of doing something while you're down there, or do you just go down there, eat, photograph, learn, or are you attempting to do something more with these now?
No, I never have an agenda when I go. I mean, maybe that's not accurate. I never have an agenda when I go anywhere to eat, other than just, sometimes I will go to a city because there's a restaurant there I really want to visit, so I will go and make a trip out of it. But for the most part, I'd say I go places to eat, places that interest me, or places that fascinate me, or food that fascinates me. And really, my desire to go down to Mexico was twofold: to see my friend Adam, but also I really wanted to learn about the culture of Mexico. Actually, before last October, I had never been to Mexico. I've been to over 30 countries around the world, and I'd never been to Mexico. And so I decided I needed to go visit the neighbor to the south. So I went down to Mexico, and I fell in love with it. Absolutely fell in love with it. And I realized there was so much to learn there.
Yeah.
And no, I go down there just because I love it.
Yeah.
I would say that's probably true of like 90% of my travels, and for food, is I just do it for the love of the game. There's no ulterior motive, so to speak, for the ulterior figure. There's just, I just love to eat.
Yeah. So what's next? I mean, do you have trips coming up?
Yes. This is going to be a busy month for me. I go from New York next week. I leave with the Bocuse d'Or team, Gavin Kaysen and Gabriel Crather, and we're going down to the Greenbrier in White Sulphur Springs, West Virginia, where next year's competitor for the United States, Richard Rosendale, is the executive chef of that resort. And so we're going to be there for a few days, sort of. He's going to be training with his coaches, Gavin and Gabriel Crather and Chef Eckertz. And I'm just going to be there as the official photographer, sort of just to kind of document the process.
Awesome.
And then from there, I go to Tahoe, and that's just a personal thing, a wedding for a friend. And then I'll be in San Francisco for a few days to eat.
Yeah.
Then I go home for 8 hours, exchange my suitcase, and I go up to Lake Champlain for a week. I'm going to be up there with Chef Gerard Kraft of Niche in St. Louis. And then we're going to go up to Montreal for a day or two and eat.
Cool.
And from Lake Champlain, I will be going to possibly Mexico again. I might be meeting Adam down in Ensenada for their crush season. It's sort of like the Napa of Mexico, where the wine region is, in Baja. And if not that, at least I'll be probably going to Tijuana. And then I'm going to a dinner in San Diego at George's at the Cove. Trey Fauché of that restaurant is hosting Christopher Costo for a charity dinner that I sort of kind of helped a friend put together. And from there, I go home for a little while. I don't know what's after that. Later this year, I have a few other trips already planned.
But I am both exhausted and starving hearing that kind of itinerary.
It is exhausting.
We're going to take a quick break and come back and hear about what other far-flung adventures Bonjoing's been on. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here with Bonchwing Lee. It must be nice to have shed the ulterior epicure and have to, you know, have this facadical guise in front of you.
It's nice. The one thing that's nice about it is, when I started the blog, the reason I went anonymous was twofold. One, I know the internet's kind of a scary place. I'm sort of a private person. And really, the blog wasn't about me. It was about the food. So it didn't really matter. I didn't think who was writing the blog. So it didn't really matter. The other main reason I was anonymous was because I was still in law school and I still hadn't found a job.
Yeah.
And employers, as you know, might be a little, especially law firms, are very curious about people's background, so they will go Google you.
Yeah.
And I didn't want my name to be attached to this, you know, this blog that, you know, this kid's not, you know, in law school studying, but he's like traveling around the world and eating. So I didn't want, you know, didn't want potential employers. But I think by going anonymous, I actually, is kind of ironic. I think I attracted more attention to myself that way, and I have a lot of very strange followers. So it's nice. And really, when I came out, I decided to do one on my own terms, because there is a creepy blog out there that was dedicated to outing me.
Oh yeah?
Yeah, it's called, and you can look it up, it's called Who is the Ulterior Epicure? And I still to this day I don't know who started the blog, but it is pretty creepy. The guy or woman, I don't know who did it, did a lot of research on me. They knew a lot of stuff about me that I don't know how they found out. They knew my beginning salary.
I didn't even know about myself.
No. But I mean, they would look up, you know, races that I had run.
Yeah.
And would link to my race, like marathons or whatever, and they would link to my race time on the sheet that was posted, you know, after a race.
Yeah.
And they would say, you know, Bonchwing Lee ran such and such a race, and Ulterior Epicure was, you know, likes to run, and would try to link me up that way, and it was done by, it was just very creepy. So I decided that I would come out on my own terms instead of letting someone else do it for me in a creepy way.
And also, by coming out on own terms, you were able to have, I think, a little more fun with it too, because you have some good friends like Gavin Kaysen, Megan Colby, that you want to dine out with and experience and not feel kind of with this wall up the whole time.
Yeah, it is tough. There was one time I was out to dinner or lunch with Gavin, and the server comes to our table, and the first thing he said, you know, I'm with Gavin Kaysen, I mean, I'm in New York City, and I would think most people know, especially in the restaurant industry, would know, and definitely at this restaurant they would have known who he was. I'm sure they did know who he was. But the first thing out of the server's mouth was not like, hello chef, or, you know, welcome to our restaurant, chef. And I was a nobody, you know, and the first thing out of his mouth is, you're that blogger from Kansas City. And that just sort of was just kind of a moment where I was like, what, you know, why?
Yeah.
Why the fuck? I really don't eat out because I want attention. I eat out because I love eating out, you know. But I do have found a lot of friends in the restaurant, and I think it's hard not to.
Yeah.
I understand that now, you know.
It's a very endearing industry.
It is. And I think it's just the love of food. We all have that in common, and, you know.
Yeah. While you're in New York, where are you eating?
On this trip, I am going to be at Aterra. I did a dinner last night at Aldea with Ideas in Food. Alex Talbot came and cooked a special dinner. So Aterra, Jean-Georges, Del Posto, The Modern, Per Se, Il Buco Elementari, Hearth. Never been to Hearth.
Oh, yeah?
Last night I happened to sit down next to Marco Canora. I'd never met him before. Such a nice guy.
I love the chef's table at Hearth.
It's such just, a nice guy. And I asked him, I said, if I have one dinner open left in New York, which I did, where should I go? And he said, Hearth. Not to be biased. And I said, all right, fair enough. So I also was in Queens earlier this week. I was at a Korean restaurant in Flushing. Went to the Queens Kickshaw. Was at the Lobster Pound in Red Hook. And yesterday we went to the sister restaurant, the Brooklyn Crab,
which
just recently opened. So a whole range of things.
Yeah.
And probably a few others, but I, you know.
And so I look at your figure right now. Where do you put it?
Yeah, that's a lot of... Marco Canora last night called me a blade of grass.
Yeah.
I guess I was just born with a very, very high metabolism, very lucky. My parents, when they were my age, were just as thin.
Yeah.
But I do exercise a lot. When I was in law school, I ran 6 miles a day.
Yeah.
Maybe a little crazy on that. But I do exercise a lot. In the summer, I love to swim.
Mm-hmm.
So I swim a lot. I just try to, you know, and the other thing is that I don't eat like this all the time, despite what people might think. I when I'm at home in Kansas City, actually, I'm almost a vegan.
Yeah.
You know, and home, I don't feel like cooking because I eat out so much. And when I eat out, it's a lot of
protein and fat.
So when I'm at home, I have lettuce. I eat salads. I love popcorn. I'll just air pop some popcorn. I love watermelon.
Yeah.
Like insanely in the summer. I love fruit, vegetables. I almost could be a vegetarian if I didn't like meat so much too, but I love vegetables.
Yeah.
And cheese is probably the only thing I have in my house that makes me not vegan at home.
Yeah. It's fascinating. I think I feel the same way about if you go out to eat at restaurants, often you order or, you know, the chef wants to present you the biggest, fattiest, juiciest,
yeah,
you know, protein.
Yeah.
So at home, I pretty much do yeah. that same thing, you know, roughage to and fiber to yeah. clean everything out.
Yeah, absolutely. You can't eat like that all the time. It would be irresponsible, and it's just not healthy. And, you know, I really believe that moderation is the key.
Yeah.
You can have your fun. I do. And thankfully, I do have a good metabolism. I do actually work for my calories. I do work out a lot. But at the same time, I think it's about moderation. And actually, when I'm at home, I usually fast one day out of the week. I won't eat one day out of the week. I just don't think it's necessary to be constantly eating. And the other thing is I have a tremendous, I don't know what it is. My mom calls me the camel because I can binge eat for a long time and then I can go a long time without food. I don't know what it is, but you know, it's just, I eat when I'm hungry.
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, obviously when I'm on these trips, I eat when I'm not hungry because, you know, but I do have a very fast metabolism.
Yeah. So Casey, when you're home and you're not vegan, vegetarian at the house, where do you eat out? Because like you were telling me, people should come to KC.
People should come to Kansas City. We have, obviously, barbecue is what we're known for. But at the same time, I think we have I would call it a burgeoning restaurant scene there. It's kind of an exciting time for Kansas City, especially for those people who grew up and lived in Kansas City. Because when I grew up in Kansas City, there were maybe one or two restaurants that would be considered, you know, fine dining or sort of pushing the envelope. The American restaurant has always been sort of the standard bearer in our city since 1974 or 3 when it opened. It's 30-some years, almost 40 years old. And they've produced a lot of great chefs, James Beard award-winning chefs. Bradley Ogden there cooked, for example, okay. early in his day. Yeah, a lot of people don't know that. But we also have now, and then a lot of chain restaurants when I grew up. I mean, it was just like a sea of Olive Gardens and Red Lobsters. That's where I grew up. And now we actually have independently run restaurants that are actually doing very well. People now in Kansas City are aware of that and are supporting that kind of a restaurant scene. So it's a really exciting time because it's, in my opinion, it's not quite there yet.
Yeah.
But Kansas City is, the chefs in Kansas City are now finally realizing that instead of chasing the trends on the coast, that we actually have a culinary heritage in the middle of the country that is great.
Yeah.
You know, that's great. And it's really funny because a few years ago, I remember in New York, there was this rage about fried chicken and pie.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm like, that's Midwestern, sort of Midwestern Southern food. I mean, the Midwest really is kind of, there are elements of Southern food there too.
Yeah.
You know, biscuits and gravy and cornbread and fried chicken and, you know, chicken fried steak and meatloaf and things like that. But, you know, chefs now are starting to realize in Kansas City that that's something to capitalize upon. That's something that we shouldn't run away from, but rather really embrace and make it better.
Yeah.
You know, I think why people make fun of Midwestern cuisine is because it's just not well done. But it doesn't mean that the food couldn't be good.
Yeah.
And so, you know, like Colby is opening a new restaurant here soon, hopefully by the end of the year, he thinks, called Rye. As in like rye whiskey, rye. And it's going to be basically that.
Yeah.
It's going to be sort of this Midwestern restaurant, but done really well with quality ingredients. You know?
Well, I think it's a quality thing. You know, Heritage Foods, which is, you know, Heritage Radio Network's founder. The meat, you know, the quality of ingredient, the sourcing, all that thing is so important. And a lot of fried chicken or a lot of barbecue were pieces of meat that you didn't know where it came from. I don't know if it was intentional or unnecessary to be told, but I feel like, you know, having good meat to do those processes makes that process and makes sure. that product better.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, like, for example, we have a great, great lamb farm, a sheep farm. out in Kansas, north of Kansas City in Weston, and it's called Green Dirt Farm. And not only do they raise these sheep, and they obviously slaughter them for the meat, the lamb, but they also make sheep's milk cheeses that are really quite spectacular. In fact, when Tony Bourdain's producers called me about him coming to Kansas City, and they said, you know, Tony really wants to roast a whole beast.
Yeah.
How can we make that happen?
Yeah, you were on no reservations.
That's right. Yeah, so that's awesome. I said, well, I've got these friends. They have a great sheep farm. I'll call them up. Let's go slaughter a lamb, and I'll invite a couple of local chefs or a local chef who also owns a farm, and we'll just roast this lamb out on the farm, because they host dinners in the summer. I just went to one last week.
Yeah.
Where they build this barn and you eat in the barn, and they host these guest chefs from the local area who come and cook, and they give each chef a whole entire lamb to feed 30 people, and people buy tickets to go. It's sort of like a supper club. And but so when Tony came, I said, you know, let's go out to this Green Dirt Farm and have this sheep roast or lamb roast. And so we did. We went out there, and he got to taste some of the cheeses, and I think he was very impressed by the cheese. I mean, and rightfully so, because the cheeses are wonderful.
Yeah.
But people don't know that, you know, the Midwest is sort of kind of developing. I think that's the other thing about Kansas City, is that we've started to really embrace the local farmers that are doing it right and doing it well.
Yeah.
And there are some really great ones out there in Kansas City.
Yeah, I mean, in the Blue Stem book.
In the Blue Stem cookbook, we actually profile 6 local food producers. We do a dairy company. We have an organic farmer, 2 actually, Thane Palmberg and the Crumbs. And then Green Dirt Farm with their lamb and cheeses, and Campo Lindo with their chickens.
Yeah.
So it's great.
Yeah, it's not subsidized.
We do sort of have this sort of produce utopia, really. The only problem with the Midwest is that we have all the seasons. Spring and fall are regrettably short. Mm-hmm. Summer is long and hot and steamy. And then winter is also pretty long. And so the winter is pretty harsh. So in the wintertime, I think it's pretty hard to be seasonal.
Yeah.
Unless you want to be eating root vegetables.
That's why you get out of town.
That's right. I do. I get to kind of...
So, on. Quickly, where would you tell people to go for just a spectacular meal anywhere in the world? What are your top few just off-the-cuff places to go?
Yeah, right now, I can probably name 3 restaurants that really excite me, that I really want to return to. One is Kike da Costa on the coast of Spain.
Yeah.
It's on the
He's opening up in New
Eastern.
York, right?
Oh, I didn't hear that. Is he? That'd be interesting. Yeah. But his restaurant is called Kike da Costa, and it's in Denia, Spain.
Yeah. Oh, no. Donnie's opening up here. Sorry.
Okay. Yeah. I didn't hear. Yeah, yeah. I didn't. Yeah. Kike da Costa.
Yeah.
I had 3 spectacular meals there, back-to-back-to-back last year there. Love to go back. His food is just like no other. Another restaurant that I think is really with the times, I think it really is representative of the times, is Pujol in Mexico City, Enrique Olvera's restaurant. He is really, I think, transforming that country's culinary scene and really revising this very ancient and very rich culinary culture with a modern viewpoint. And I think it's really great. And the other one is Josh Skeen's Et Saison in San Francisco, who is cooking food that all 3 of those chefs have very individualistic voices. Very individualistic voices.
Yeah.
And I think it's really exciting. Those 3 restaurants, I would say, those 3 are the top right now, are the most exciting restaurants that excite me the most.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a pretty hefty list. How many restaurants have you eaten at?
Oh, I don't even know.
Because I see that list on Ulterior Epicure.
Yeah, and that's not even exhaustive. I need to go and update that.
Yeah.
I don't know. Hundreds. Hundreds, definitely.
Yeah. But I like hearing those 3 as ones that you'd return to.
Oh, absolutely.
So you're not a one-off kind of guy.
Never, actually. Even if my first meal is disappointing, I'll go back. I've had many disappointing meals at any kind of restaurant, and I never write it off after the first visit. Not even after 2. I'll go. I'll go as many times as I think it takes for me to determine that restaurant maybe is just not for me.
Yeah.
And I'm always open. You know, like, for example, a good example is WD-50. The first time I went there, it still is probably among the worst meals I've ever had.
Yeah.
And a few years later, everyone just kept telling me, you have to go. You have to go back. You know, you probably just had a bad visit. And I went back, and the second meal I had there was probably one of the best meals I've ever had in my life.
Yeah.
And it just goes, I mean, I'm very open to that. I'm very adventurous. I never write anything off. Life's too short to do that.
Yeah. And are you hungry right now?
Absolutely.
Okay, so we're going to have some lunch.
Absolutely. Looks good. I'm staring at Roberta's right now.
Yeah.
It's great.
Excellent. Bondring, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Everyone should check out the Ulterior Epicure and read, not only just
thank
look
you.
At photos. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, hoping to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our programs archived on our website or by searching iTunes for Heritage Radio Network. You can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website. Thanks for listening.